talk about what meditation is, because there's a lot of interesting ideas around floating around the world. The one we've mentioned a few times is the one that kind of generally the world thinks of as meditation. It's, but even then there are very many understandings of it, and that's okay. Like I said, Buddha's not a creator, he doesn't own the word. People can make up their own, it doesn't matter. You want to think of doing a Buddhist meditation, you can hear what you're trying to do and why you're doing it. So there's basically two modes of meditation. Mirror the techniques. Let's first understand what the purpose is, what you're trying to do. Right? In the West, it's fine, people think you're just meditating, trying to be calm, trying to relax. You can think like that, that's fine, that's not the Buddhist stuff. We need to be more than that, a billion times more than that. So I've used these terms that the world knows, if you study Buddhist books and things. You know, the first one is known. They're known, both of them are called, are labeled in terms of their end result. So the first one, you know, it's known in English, it's translated, calm, abiding. And it's a Sanskrit word, shamatha. People might know that word. You know? Calm, abiding. The other one is called insight. And again, English is really clear. In many cultures, there's no real word equivalent of the ordinary English word insight, which is great because we use it, it's very modern, it's a lovely word, very special. You get the meaning, inner seeing. Like, oh, I got some insight into that problem yesterday. You get it exactly the meaning, it's a really delicious word. So that mantra, of course, in Sanskrit is Vipassana. So there's many techniques that Buddha taught. The one that's sort of popular in the world, known as Vipassana, there's almost like its own little religion now, because there are particular people who do just that technique, just this technique. It's basically a technique based upon concentration, the first one. The first one is this single point of concentration. When you've achieved this calm abiding, you would have accomplished what they call single point of concentration. And that's what's described in terms of nine stages of cultivation, you know? And like I said, this technique is created by the Indians, well before the Buddha, genius yogis, you know. So the second one, the first one, is so that you can get a focused mind. Speak ordinary terms. Okay, the level of focus, the level of concentration is kind of radical. But it's sort of fairly evident, you know. Thinking in really ordinary terms. If you're trying to study music, you've got to develop insight into music. I mean, it's a simple way of putting it. The goal is to develop insight into music, isn't it? That's the goal. If you're going to do cooking, the goal is insight into cooking. But, you know, just what he did is whatever he did. What is it? Horticulture. I keep hearing it here.
Yes.
Thank you very much. You had to study horticulture, didn't you? So you had to get insight into the laws and things of horticulture, right?
Right.
Okay, so you need a bit of practice, don't you? You couldn't concentrate for more than 1 second, you'd be a peanut, wouldn't you?
That's horticulture, yes.
How many practice? Yes. So, I mean, we all kind of get this. So don't put it in holy words. Try and think of these states. These two words are very ordinary. They are ordinary, so use an ordinary example that will understand it. Otherwise, as soon as we call it Buddhist, we lose the plot. I can't describe to you the demented ideas people have about it. So the job is to get insight into music. We better learn to concentrate. The job is to develop insight into horticulture, insight into whatever it is you're trying to do, even just to know how to get someplace, minus your Google map and your little lady telling you where to go. You'd better use your noggin and concentrate, or you'll miss the turn. It's sort of evident, you know? But the goal, the point of concentration is to get insight. The point of having the first mode is to get insight. So clearly insight into what, if we're being a Buddhist? Well, it's obvious. Insight into the way things exist, if you're choosing to study Buddhist view of reality. So you want to get insight into that. So insight is a function of the mind, isn't it? Not the nose or the toenail, the mind. So the So the Buddha happens to have this technique that the Indians created, which is an ingenious, brilliant, unbelievable skill to get ingenious, unbelievable, brilliant concentration at a level of mind that we don't even posit as existing, but the principle is the same. So I think what one thinks, to get insight into reality, ultimately to realize that, we're going to go through all these words, don't worry about it now, to see ultimately how things are, or another simple way to put it, to get insight into how things exist so that we can finally cut the root of the nonsense ego grasping that is the root cause of all suffering since beginning of time, according to Buddha's analysis, to cut that from our mind, which is so subtle and so primordial, to cut that from the mind, finally, so we can then finally get rid of suffering and its causes, which are all these neuroses in the mind and our part of karma. We can't do that until we've accessed the mind at a subtle level, because it's so primordially deep. So when you get this concentration, as I've said, when you get it, and most of us, won't get it, unless we study really seriously how to practice for many years, but it's there available to us, living right now, this extant technique for thousands of years, you've got to access a subtler, more focused, more profoundly capable level of cognition. That's what this technique enables. Now, you can be, the Hindus, the way they talk about it, the qualities, and Ramayesha talks in his book, the qualities that you would cultivate just having concentration is so amazing, you wouldn't believe it. Even as I said before, but Renee, just accomplished the fifth of the nine stages of this technique. Incredible control of his mind. Incredibly, you become this marvelous person with effortless capacity to know yourself intimately and well and to change yourself in a most radical way, to get insight into, in other words. So, speaking in normal, ordinary, day-to-day life level of being a Buddhist, not even being a Buddhist, okay? So let's say, using just an example again, he goes to school, he decides he wants to become a horticulturist, what are you deciding to become? So he goes and listens to the class, doesn't he? He listens to the notes. He's got to probably write notes because his memory's perfect. He's got to write on his computer. And then his teacher says, go home and do your homework, babe, doesn't he? Don't they? That means he has to go home and get some insight into it, so it becomes entire. He internalizes it. So first you start off at the conceptual level, don't you, with all the information. Like if I learned for the first time 1 + 1 = 2. Oh, mummy, Miss Hoff, the nuns told me that 1 + 1 = 2. Oh, so difficult, never heard that before. It was true, I didn't ever have that before. So my teacher probably, if she'd been a Buddhist, she would have said, this is the reason, go home, take the information I've given you, you've got to have that. And I want you to go get some insight into it. That means go do your homework. She wants me to internalize that information, it's pretty evident. But she would say first, go home and get some concentration first, babe. Close your door, tell the sisters and brothers to go away, get a bit of single point of concentration. Now that you've got a little bit of focus, go to the second mode, and now get some insight into this information I'm just giving you. We understand, that's called learning something. We're geniuses at it. So in order to get insight into that, or horticulture, 1 + 1 = 2, or karma, or impermanence, or the mind, or the delusions, or emptiness, or bodhicitta, the whole spectrum of Buddha's philosophical model, the information, is what he is saying is a description of how reality is, and you decide to buy into that view of reality, which is what I've done, so I need to get insight into it. How can I be speaking one syllable of one word in this room right here if I hadn't developed some understanding, even intellectually, of it? I mean, in other words, I'm a complete and total fraud. That would be very shocking. So insight is very level, various levels. You have gross insight. It's quite whatever you want. It's easy, it's obvious. Even intellectuals can be profound. So you just keep getting better at both. The deeper you go with your concentration, the more focus you've got, the more marvelous your capacity for cognition, the more deep you can go in your unpacking and unraveling, the more complex ways that things exist, which aren't evident to us at the gross level. And that's how you eventually become a Sangha, an enlightened being. Sangha, rid of the rubbish, full of the goodness. It's a gradual, ongoing, incremental process of internalizing. But it's this technique of concentration is a very sophisticated, marvelous, amazing psychological skill that anybody would benefit from. A communist could do it. It's not wholly in its nature, I promise. If you say taking the breath as your object of concentration, and we'll do a little bit of meditation here, so we're going to use the mind. This is not religious at this stage, it's not spiritual, it's practical. It's intelligence. So that you can get some focus. So you can do whatever you're going to do and get insight into whatever you want to get insight into, which is the second mode. So, if you, okay, okay. So the concentration one is the first one, to get the mind honed, so we can begin to get some focus. Now that's not easy in itself. We all know how berserk our minds are, and we all know, even when we're doing a bit of meditation every day, it doesn't seem to change much, it still seems to be berserk, right? So we can get easily depressed by that, but don't, it's a long way to go. You won't get much concentration, unless you come into this life with a strong practice from past lives, and you've really got the ability to do it, like, you know, in your home, in between work. It's only unusual for most to get serious concentration. It's really quite sophisticated. But you can get some benefit from attempting the technique almost immediately. So that's the key here. So what benefit would come if you have a small practice in the morning, 5 minutes to start your day? You might not get much concentration. Don't be depressed about that. But the key point is this. And we're going to do it, okay? We'll do a 5 minute session. Just give it a go. Many of you are familiar with it, of course. So what basically what it is, it's a training. You're training your mind to pay attention to one thing. You're training yourself to pay attention to one thing. Now, why would you want to do that? Because we can see that the tendency of the mind is to do the exact opposite. To follow every, even though we're not conscious of the thoughts, but we're sort of mindlessly absorbed in all our thoughts and feelings, aren't we? We're having these endless conversations. We're not just listening passively to all the thoughts in there. We're having these endless conversations. They're quite dynamic all the day. If you've been hurt by something, you don't even notice it. Oh, it's not fair, they thought this, I didn't do that, it's not fair, why did I think this, why I didn't do this, I'm really just a bad person. It's actually a dialogue. We're not just listening to passive thoughts. It's a dialogue we're having all the time. The tragedy is we don't notice. If you were spending all day having a dialogue about love and compassion and kindness, you are fine, honey. You don't need concentration. You're okay. But who is? None. Even if we do have positive thoughts, they're usually kind of resentful. Well, I'm really better than they think I am. That's not positive. That's twisted. We don't have happy, positive thoughts. It kind of sounds so ridiculous to think like this. It's like corny, you know? I did a really good job. Well done, Ravina. It's rare that we have positive, rejoicing, optimistic, kind, respectful, self-confident thoughts. That if it is confident, it's like arrogance. Oh, I'm so much better than those people think I am. Oh, I'm the worst person in the universe. I should kill myself. It's always kind of a twist to it. That's the delusion voices. And then the old habits, yes? And they've all got an edge to them, you know? And it's always in reference to other people, the world out there. Walk down the shop, you go to buy some milk. Hello, good morning, how are you? And she looks grumpy at you. Have a dialogue. Who she thinks she is. I mean, you know my point, you understand. On the road, you're driving, and a car doesn't come, you go mad for the rest of the day. It's violent dialogue. We're so like lemmings, okay? We're complete. With the delusion that we should be crying with passion for ourselves, not beating ourselves up for them. They run us, and we're so with these delusions and attachment, it's like we're really sensitive people. We get hurt so easily, get upset so easily, get offended so easily, get thrown so easily, get frustrated, annoyed, irritated, upset easily. The tiniest thing can throw us. We're so fragile, you know. That's because of delusion. So why do you want, in the beginning, why do you want to attempt to pay attention to one thing? Is it's a training. If we're training with strong determination, do 5 minutes, and that's long, 5 minutes, believe me. We're training to pay attention, and the typical object the Buddha started teaching is a very simple one. You get more sophisticated, we'll do one later. You start with the sensation at your nostrils when the air goes in and out. And it's a really simple one because it happens naturally. You don't have to conjure the breath, it occurs, you know. There's many things you can focus on to use as your focal point to pay attention. So now, in the neutral states of mind, these mechanics, as I like to call them, and we know all the English words, but Buddha's got a very clear definition of each of these and exactly their function. It's quite sophisticated. So one is called attention. One is called intention. And that intention is like, is the linear karma, the start of the mind, I will. Concentration. The term mindfulness is one of many of these states of mind. That all of which, when they're working nicely, doing their jobs properly, we will function as a reasonable person. There's one called discrimination. It's happening every millisecond. And it's the capacity automatically there that enables us to distinguish between the pink and the blue and the white and the red, and that car is 5 feet from me instead of 7 feet. It's constantly going up. It's an ingenious part of our mind. Unless it were working, we would be insane. Attention is the same. Each one of them has their own function. And it's quite distinct in this Buddhist model. And this is all coming from these amazing Indians who map the mind internally and identify all these states of mind and their function. So in concentrated meditation, we're trying to train the attention. We're training the mindfulness. There's another one called vigilance. We're training. In the beginning, right now, we haven't got a clue, but we say the word. We can't point, oh, there's attention, there's attention, there's this one. There's just a bit super kind of doing things, but they're all doing their jobs nicely. Like all the bits of your hand are all working perfectly because you've trained it. Also, imagine doing all the right thing. You never go the ligament here and the muscle there unless you're paralyzed or learn it again. It's all doing their job beautifully to fulfill the function of a total hand. Our mind is like that. But as we progress with concentration and meditation, we get very skillful at recognizing these parts and we're training these parts. So what we're training, we learn to pay attention, but the goal is to get concentration. Meaning to stay on one object, no matter what the obstacles are, no matter what the distractions are, you won't get thrown. That is, right now we're like little birds, emotionally. The moment there's a big noise, it's like our mind is magnetized to it, we run to it, and then have this very vivid opinion about it and get upset. No wonder we're exhausted by the end of the day, because we're forever being distracted by everything in the planet. And then we have all these interpretations of them, and they're usually negative. We're exhausted by the end of the day. So this paying attention is to simply pay attention to that sensation. Now, the fact is, the moment you start to do it, already you're trying to step out of your head, aren't you? You're deciding. So I sort of read the analogy like the room is your head, okay? Let's say in this room there's like 100 people all chatting away. And that's your mind, 100 thoughts a second, you know. And you're dying to know everybody's discussion, what they're saying. So what you're trying to do with the analogy with the room in your head, you decide there's a spot on the wall, and you're going to pay attention to that. And you're not going to ask people to be quiet. You're not going to ask them to go away. You're going to train, you're going to strengthen your ability to stay focused on that thing and not get distracted. So obviously in the beginning, all you can do is hear all the voices shouting and yelling. But you've got to have the courage, you notice yourself immediately wandering off. What would Mary say? Back to the breath, Olivia, back to that spot. You pay attention. And if you keep wandering off 50 times a minute, bring yourself back to 50 times a minute to the spot, you're training your mind to pay attention. Every time you bring yourself away from the distraction, you're training yourself. It's like being on a bike. The first time you get on a bike on the left, you fall off on the right. Then you pick yourself up again, don't you? You get back on the bike, and you fall off again. Well, if you suddenly forget what you're doing and get distracted, oh, look at the lovely sky. Well, you've got to be fine. You want to get on a bike again. You've got to keep remembering to get back on the bike. You've got to bring yourself back to the point. Bring yourself back to the point. Bring yourself back to the point. So immediately what we say is, oh, I had a terrible meditation. Why? What happened? Oh, my thoughts are so busy. Well, join the universe. What's special? It's how it is. Those all thoughts are all there chatting away. We're training ourselves to pay attention so that as we know this is true, if you're really attached to somebody, if you're in love with somebody, I remember. And you have your fantasies. You can be in a football field of 150,000 people, you won't care, you will concentrate effortlessly. you understand my point? So when the mind has got some vested interest in concentration, nothing can distract us. If you're really angry with somebody, you don't have to say, be quiet, I'm trying to concentrate on being angry. You know you're really focused. So we know how to focus. Except here, it's kind of boring because the breath is not so exciting, you know? And there's nothing really grabbing us. But we all know, if you are trying to pay attention and you're really angry with your boyfriend, it's almost impossible to pay attention. But it's still good to try. It's good to train yourself. To train yourself. And it's training. So be humble. You're training. Now, we might not get concentration very far in this life because we're not doing it very much. You've got to really do it seriously in terms of retreats and for many days and weeks and months to really get some genuine realization, one, two, three, or four levels, whatever, before it just disappears again. It's quite an intense and amazing technique, demanding all this effort and discipline and courage and confidence and perseverance, no question. Because the mind doesn't want to pay attention. We are addicted to wandering off, you know. So the benefit that even comes from attempting to pay attention to the sensation at the tip of your nose, and you do a bit every day, the immediate benefit won't be that much concentration, but I'll tell you the benefit. Because for that 5 minutes, you're making an effort to step out of your head, aren't you? You're making an effort to focus on that, not just blindly absorb yourself in all the silly thoughts, mindlessly raging on. So you're attempting to be conscious. So the thought will be there, raging on. It doesn't matter. This is number one. This is not a relaxation technique. Yoga has amazing relaxation techniques, and we really need them because we're all demented. But this is absolutely not a relaxation technique. The opposite. You have to make incredible effort. Two, it is not, the purpose of this technique is not to make the thoughts go away. That's beyond ridiculous. An absurd nonsense. It is not to have some special feeling. It is not to have some special vision. None of they all are just nonsense made up rubbish, you know? It's a bare bones, simple training to set, because you've decided I'm going to watch the breath. Determination. I'm going to watch the breath. And so what's happening, if you're doing it properly, attention watches the breath. Mindfulness, which is like a part of your mind, like I said before, that is enabling you to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. So then every time you wander off, kind of mindfulness brings it back. And then there's another part of you, which now I'm calling the policeman, it's called vigilance. These are regular English words, okay? And that's another part that's kind of got an all overview. And you really only notice these as you get very sophisticated in meditation. And that is watching even the mindfulness is doing its job. Well, the best we can do is imagine this, you know. So we just think, I'm watching my breath. But it's very helpful to say, attention is watching the breath. Mindfulness is keeping it on track. Alertness does this. Vigilance does that. Discrimination does that. They're very unique and precise, these parts of the mind. And when you learn it, you know it really well. So you can imagine all doing their jobs, you know. So the immediate benefit, if you do a little bit of this every day, would be that because you practiced making an effort to stop blindly following every thought, you will actually start to feel that your thoughts are getting worse. They say that's a sign of success. No, you're now more conscious of the thoughts. Because even they're there, you're not paying attention to them, but it's like noise in the background. Because, you know, all the football people screaming down the road, you're still paying attention to do your job, and you can hear them all shouting, but you're not paying attention to them. You're paying attention to what you're doing here. Then you know they're all there, but they're not disturbing you. And that's how we have to learn. So one of the immediate benefits of learning a little bit of this to do every day is that you then, normally you're up in the morning, you feel kind of something really wrong, and you're depressed from yesterday, but you're not paying attention, but it's on the line. You know, on autopilot, go to the toilet, pick your nose, get your breakfast, do this, but it's autopilot, mindlessly doing the usual things we do, looking at the weather, doing this. But we know all the thoughts are going on crazy, but we're not paying attention to anything. There's no awareness there. There's no sharpness there. So the benefit that will come as you do this every day is that Because you're familiar with paying attention to something, you're going to be more vividly aware of all the thoughts chatting away while you're doing your coffee, while you're on the toilet. And then you're going to be consciously doing a bit of insight, getting a bit of insight. Please hear me literally. You're being more conscious of your thoughts, and you're not just allowing them to be there and sinking into them. And, oh, I'm so depressed, blah, blah, blah. What did you think of the last 10 minutes? You've been no idea. You become more conscious. Then you start to become more in control of the thoughts. So let's say that some residual result of a fight with your brother yesterday, you know? And it starts raging on in your head again. And you don't even notice it. You're wondering why you feel you're depressed. You can't even notice it. But you notice now. Give it a break with me. He doesn't mean it. You understand that. It's all right. He said this and did this. So just think it through for a second. You become more conscious. And you use this bit of focus that you're training yourself to get and ability to step out of your head to actually have intelligent conversations with yourself. That's how you get insight. So rather than just following the feelings, holding all the resentment, building it all up, and years later you still hate your brother. But you become conscious at whatever level. And even you hear the thoughts a little bit, you bring the good roommates out, your kindness, your intelligence, your patience. It's all right with Ben, it's okay, he doesn't mean it, blah, blah, blah. And you can solve your problem. You can get inside into it, and then you can leave it alone. And you fixed it. You fixed that little one. Whereas what happens with us, we're mindless, we don't notice, the story's built up, we have the fight, we have the worry, all the anxiety, all the conversations, and we're not aware, they just get worse, they get worse, and we have to go get a pill because we're going to go crazy or kill somebody. Because we only then notice it when the wheels are falling off. That's when the serious stuff happens. But this is learning to become familiar with your thoughts and feelings before they go berserk. And that's the skill that you bring to bear from training yourself to simply pay attention. You develop you're aware more clearly of the thoughts, but just blindly absorbed in them. So then when you're driving a car, whereas normally once you get, you know, that it's all building up internally, you're not conscious of it, you're not labeling anything, you're not having an intelligent conversation, you're not in charge of it, you're sort of allowing it to drag you by the nose, you know. The car comes in front, you want to kill it. But here, you're noticing what's in your mind, you're aware of the silly stories, you're arguing with yourself. That's getting insight. This is an ordinary level of ordinary applying of these ordinary techniques. You see, the text of course talks about ultimate concentration and insight into ultimate reality. Wave it over me, one step at a time. Are we communicating? This is just it's being intelligent, becoming more aware of your thoughts. It is chaos. But you do your best to start hearing ones over the most of the surface, and then slowly you start having these more conscious conversations with yourself, kind ones, intelligent ones. If you hear the guilt and the shame, give yourself a break with it. That is an exaggerated decision. You are not that. And that's where the more we think about these delusions, we're going to talk more about, and recognize how they're all exaggerated, distorted opinions. Then you'll recognize how outrageous anger is against yourself, how outrageous guilt is. Give yourself a break with it. It's not how it is. And you literally use analysis, but you be your own therapist. Like Tommy Yeezy said. It takes time and courage, but when we swim in the misery, and it's our habit for so long, it takes a while. This is what day-to-day practice is in your ordinary life. There's nothing mystical about it. And of course, if you're a Buddhist, you know, if you're a Tibetan Buddhist, you do other things, and visualization, you do mantra, you do all sorts of other things, which are techniques that help you even more do this job. This is the actual job of being a Buddhist. Working on your mind every day, every step. And you get to get better and better and better and better at it. Like anything. That's it. It's not complicated. It's just hard work, but it's possible. And as you get more concentration, or whatever, you get better at the job of seeing and listening. And then, of course, you delve deeper, and you go ever deeper levels of anger, ever deeper levels of jealousy, ever deeper levels. And you can unpack and unravel at an ever deeper level, and until you're really radically reconfiguring these conceptual dramas in here, you know, rather than feeling like a complete victim of them, and blaming the drugs, and blaming the mummy, and blaming the daddy, and blaming the girlfriend, and blaming everything else, never looking itself into the thoughts themselves. This is daily practice, I promise. And it gets better and better. And then you see, because it's like becoming more grown up. Maybe my boyfriend just left me and I'm shattered. But when you're doing this job internally, you're not a victim of it. You're dealing with it, even though you're a therapist. Then maybe I'll meet you, I haven't seen you for 10 years. I'm really having a great time. How are you there? Oh, I'm really well. How are you, sweetheart? You would never know I'm having a problem because you get better at doing this job. Whereas now we wear our heart on our sleeve. We're naked to everybody what's going on inside us because we can't work with it. We can't hold it. We can't understand it because we're not conscious of it until it becomes unbearable. That's why it's so painful to deal with our emotions, because we wait till the wheels fall off before we do anything about them. I'm sure we can be here, don't we? So this is doing a little concentration meditation, using our breath first, okay? So the key here is, I'll just go through the physical posture, which is from the experience of these yogis for thousands of years, and it's all practical. So because these Asians, they sit cross-legged, they're very good at it, they've all found that sitting with what they call full lotus position, which most of us aren't that flexible, is extremely stable. So the people doing years of retreat, which is indeed what people do, doing this inner job ever deeper, ever deeper, ever deeper, unpacking, unraveling, they can stay stable sitting upright for a long, long time, days after days after days after weeks, so you never fall over. So the full lotus position has been found to be really excellent, okay? If you can do it, fantastic. If not, Dalai Lama says, even if you can start your session with sitting in full lotus, it's really auspicious for being able to do it in the future, because when you get really advanced meditation techniques, way beyond what we're talking here, then it's necessary to, the subtler energies need to be kind of configured in a certain kind of way, and that's a really excellent technique, a way to sit. So, but if you can't, that's fine, just sit normally cross-legged. If you can't do that, like most of us here, we are sitting in chairs, okay? So when sitting in chairs, you better keep your body upright, and have your feet firmly planted on the ground, and don't slump into the back of the chair, because that's the benefit of sitting cross-legged. You've got to hold your own body upright, and then the mind can stay very stable, and without getting, if you slump, the mind becomes kind of sleepy, you know? Okay. So first point is about 8 points of the posture. Is your legs, so then you do what you can. So then the next one is a cushion. So if you're very flexible, like some people are, can really put their legs, if your legs are in full lotus, you just need a little cushion propped up under your coccyx, just to sort of give you a sense of being held upwards. It's very helpful. But each of us has to find what cushions work for us. We're all different, you know? The third one is your spine. And the fourth one is your shoulders. So in general, meaning your skeleton, your bones. So they should be very upright. Okay, but the trouble is, we know with all the soft bits hanging on the bones, the muscles, as soon as we sit upright, we tense our muscles, especially the abdomen and the shoulders. So sit upright, I think of it as this way, think of it as your spine, your skeleton is hanging on a hanger. It's completely straight, isn't it? And then think of all the soft bits hanging on the skeleton, but no tension whatsoever. So it's a combination of really upright, but completely relaxed. So, now sit upright, and then consciously flop your muscles. The abdomen, we don't know what the fact do is, we always tense our muscles of the abdomen. Flop your muscles, the shoulders, the abdomen, all your muscles, relax them, but you're sitting upright. It's a perfect combination. The hands, everybody does something different. Each yogi finds their own way to meditate. But the classic one that we're taught, you'd sit like this, with the left hand underneath, the right hand on top, and the thumbs touching, forming a triangle. That's the legs, the bottom, the back and the shoulders, and the hands. Now And the main thing now is the head. So it's good not to have the head tilted backwards. That makes the mind agitated. So the mind, the head slightly tilted forward, chin tucked in, just a little bit. The next is the jaw, very relaxed. Lips apart, slightly. And then curiously, but there's logic to it, the tip of the tongue resting behind the top teeth, just near the palate. And all the yogis have found, for those who are meditating a long time, this prevents you from dribbling. It's very practical. From having to swallow spit all the time. So the tip of the tongue behind the top teeth, jaw relaxed. Lips slightly apart, breathing through your nose, head tilted forward. And then finally, your eyes. All the great meditators who meditate throughout the day as well, because one of the dangers is to go to sleep, which is very kind of get very dull. We'll go into it. We'll talk about this after we've done the technique. Then they keep their eyes open, but because their focus is so powerful, they don't get distracted. They're totally internal, but it keeps the light coming in, so it keeps the mind very sharp. This is a little session we're going to do, 3 or 4 minutes maybe. Let's have our eyes lightly closed, and then you're looking a lot. Your eyes are down, looking down, as if you're looking along your nose towards the ground. That's the classic position. Okay. So the body, though, doesn't meditate. It's just making it conducive for the mind to do its job. So now forget about the body, okay? That's the first thing, the body. Now the next thing is we're going to locate the sensation at the tip of our nose, which is slightly different when you breathe in from when you breathe out. So just locate that sensation. So just take a couple of breaths. And anyway, take a couple of deep, complete breaths, not loud, but you shouldn't hear it, right down to your abdomen. Feel the abdomen moving horizontally. Not loud, but very complete, full breath, but locate the sensation at your nostrils. Couple of breaths, just to steady and then locate the sensation. Okay, that's what we're going to focus on. So now, with determination, I'm going to pay attention to that sensation as the breath goes out, as the breath comes in. Just pay attention to that sensation. So naturally, your mind will, your attention will wander off, I promise. You'll either, and there's two things, we'll go into this later, you'll either become all chatty and excited and forget about what you're doing, or you'll start going sleepy. And even in 2 minutes, people can fall asleep. Because we don't notice. So the two main obstacles are, I call excitement and dullness, and we'll discuss this later. So it's like you're going to watch, imagine the mindfulness watching like a hawk, you're going to have that attention on the breath. The second you notice it wanders off, bring it back to the breath, bring it back to the breath, bring it back to the breath. And it doesn't matter how many times you bring it back, that's a sign of success because you just don't space out, you've been conscious. So the job is, I'm going to pay attention to that sensation. That's it. Just the breath. Bring your mind back to the breath. Keep the attention sharp, focused, not spaced out. Adjust it, keep it sharp.
just the verb. Stony verb is just the verb. Relax now. That's about 4 minutes, I think. And it's better to do a series in 4 minutes with a quick break than to sit and do 20, because 90% of the 20 will just sink or space out thinking and meditating. It's really incredible to be so rigorous in realizing it's not relaxation, it's not spacing out, it's not just feeling good, it's learning to pay attention. Because I've developed a really sharp mind. That's the plan. Any questions from that? Huh? Anybody? Does anybody need to go to sleep? Yes, that's it, isn't it? So it was 3 minutes, 4 minutes. So that's really interesting. And so this is so fascinating. In all the texts and all the descriptions of this technique, the key. The way you navigate all this, and again, it gets very sophisticated how they describe the different things at different stages, but the key two obstacles to this concentration, which, if you like, almost the two main obstacles have to be completely conquered, which, you know, when you finally accomplish it, you've completely conquered these two. These are the tendency of the mind to chat away. They call it excitement, the mind's chatting away. Normal. That's our, and you think about it, that's our daily activity. The mind is just, and there's a good side of it. You can keep the mind very sharp, you get lots of jobs done, the mind never stopping thinking, never stopping. We can channel that in daily life, it's very useful, it means getting things done, it's great. But the obstacle when you sit down and be quiet, so you can't even sit one night, you think you're going mad, the berserk mind. That's the mind, they call that excitement, out of control thoughts. The other one, you just experience, and that's not uncommon. They call it dullness. The mind sinks, and within 2 minutes you can be asleep. So if you don't, that's where you have. This is where the meaning of mindfulness is: this part of your mind that is watching like a hawk. The second you see it, you see the attention weakening. Okay. The second you catch it and you sharpen it again. So that shows how we are aware of our mind, isn't it? It shows really how unconscious we are. Do you understand? It's a very good example. So that was 3 minutes for me. So we go in between dullness and excitement. And honestly, this as you progress, if you're doing it seriously in the mountains, you know, month after month, you're lessening the dullness and you're lessening the excitement. And what that means is you're getting more deep attention. The mind's going more deep, more deep, more deep, more sharp, more sharp, more powerful, more powerful. But it's until almost you get to the seventh stage, you almost you've got to be continually going between. They talk about gross excitement, gross suppleness, gross dullness. Then subtle excitement, subtle dullness. And as Lavinetti says in the book, if you can get to a state of maybe the, I don't know what level, fifth or sixth or something, where you really think you've got concentration, but you've got this subtle state of thick dullness. But it's so subtle you think it's concentration. So it's really a refined, sophisticated technique. And just to sit there thinking you can do it on your own is like a joke. You really need to be qualified to do it properly, and you really need excellent instruction by a person who knows what they're talking about. Whereas that's fine just thinking you just close your eyes and do what you like. No one says you can't do that, you're the boss. But if you want to do this technique, you better get proper instructions, please. Otherwise you just space out and you're ridiculous. Are we here? So you're navigating all the time. So it's quite complicated because it's sort of like when you first learn to drive, it's really complicated. So many things to focus on just to get this job done. But we know when you get it done right, you can do it naturally. Everything's the same, including this.
That's why you've got to know that what you're doing is the right thing. You've got to have the right instructions, you know, and know the purpose of it. So you're all the time adjusting the mind between the excitement and the dullness. So concentrate, this is my way of putting it, okay? But we can see in daily life, isn't it? Excitement is our natural state. And when that's, and it's got a really good quality, when you, if you're sitting there just sitting on your own, you go nuts with a crazy mind. But if you start to put your crazy mind into function, you can do things, you get things done, you make the cakes, you go here, you do there, you can achieve lots of things. It's all for ordinary life, isn't it? And that's the function of having a very busy mind, you can achieve lots of things. That we can see that state of mind is very sharp and bright when you're wide awake and wound up and you get lots of things done. That's actually the excitement energy, and it's really driven by attachment. But we can utilize it, we can harness that. And the quality of that when you're really wide awake and wound up and getting lots of things done, there's the real quality of that busy mind is it's a sharp mind, sharp as a needle. You get my point here? Can you hear that? But then look at the other extreme, dullness. Dull is when the mind sinks down. And of course, it goes to sleep. So we have the extremes of berserk all day and then complete dullness of the sleep. They're the two extremes of these two. So in meditation, what you're trying to do is concentration meditation, is kind of, it's my way of putting it. To develop this attention, this focus that has the sharpness, sharp as a needle, which you could say is a characteristic of excitement mind. So you've got to retain the sharpness without the berserk. And you've got to have calm without the dull. Can you hear that? So the state of concentration is a state we would never experience. It's a brilliantly laser-like, sharp state of mind that is completely still and calm. So it seems like almost a contradiction for us. When you're dull, you start, you're calm and still. When you're sharp, you berserk. So it's almost like impossible for us to get to that one, but that's what we have to accomplish. It's quite a sophisticated, and you have to understand it exactly. And all these states of mind are described very precisely. Any questions? Yeah.
It's like introspection, would that be synonymous with mindfulness?
Or is it the word introspection.
Sorry?
The word introspection is, you read that somewhere. Yeah, the word introspect. Yeah, no, this is the biggest problem is all the translators use different terms to translate into better terms. So introspection is another word for alertness or vigilance. And it's, I'm in a sense where I can't even see the relationship. That's a translation of what another Tibetan word is. And so vigilance or alertness or introspection are referring to the same one. And so for me, I find it very confusing, but that's why some of the scholars use introspection.
Sorry.
Confusing to me. Mindfulness is like, they call it, some of the lovely people refer to it as memory. But it's the ability to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. And you get to a certain state where you've got perfect mindfulness, you're brilliant, incredible concentration. But eventually you don't need to apply it anymore. You've perfected it. And you really get more, and then you get eventually get single point of concentration. And you're really qualified people can get it in 6 months, and it's highly advanced. But even the best qualified ordinary people take several years to get in serious intensive retreat. Any questions? Okay. So there's lots of things you can use to focus on, to pay attention to. The breath is the classic one. The Buddha started as a beginning one. But eventually, as you get more advanced in your practice and in your spiritual practice in general, that's too gross an object because it's still external, it's physical. Eventually, because you've got to go to a state of mind that's beyond the physical, you can use an internal object. That would be, sometimes we use a visualization, sometimes we use the mind itself. And that's one that Lama Yeshe teaches in this book here. Not this book here. Sorry, I keep pointing there. My iPad's not there. It's this book called Mahamudra. So what Mahamudra is, it's the same, using the same modes of meditation, concentration and insight, but it's a more advanced technique because what you're trying to get insight into is ultimate reality, emptiness. We won't talk about that yet. And the difference is that when you start with the focusing part, you don't focus on the breath. You use your own mind itself. The thoughts that arise, that becomes your focus. And that's kind of weird for us. We don't quite know, and we'll do it later. But it's got much more power.
As Lama says, when the mind is so powerful, and when you can use the mind as your focus, and when even when your mind can become more calm, more still, then you get a much more powerful kind of experience of the clarity of your own mind. It's very tasty. Lama talks about it very beautifully. And then the second mode is we try to get insight into the emptiness, first of the self, and then eventually of the mind. So it's a very sophisticated technique. On the face of it, it appears very simple. But it's very delicious, especially when the Lama talks about it. Very inspiring. It gives a taste of our marvellous qualities, you know, our marvellous mind. So one of the things he talks about a lot is like, it's in here, it's a chapter. I'll tell you from the book. You should read it. I'd like you to read it, please. Lama's chapter, Meditate on the Clear Nature of Our Mind. That's extracted from this book, Mother Mudra. So just read a bit of it now. It's very tasty. It's very nice to hear it. I'll read it to you.
What page?
Okay, let me read it out. Just listen to this. Treat it like a meditation. This is Lama Yeshe's word, not my stupid word. This is Lama Yeshe's word. Okay, maybe you're not sure what it means to meditate on your mind. The Mahamudra way is to concentrate on the clarity of your mind, its conventional nature. But we start by focusing on our concepts, the views of our own thoughts, the viewpoints of it, all crazy thoughts. In other words, in order to discover the clarity of our consciousness, the object of our meditation, we first observe the thoughts. By becoming quiet, we purify the grosser levels of our consciousness, all the dualistic thoughts about good and bad, the worldly superstitions, the artificial concepts, and negative thoughts. This creates space. Whether you're confused or miserable, blissful or in some fantastic clear-light experience, it doesn't matter. Simply watching the feelings, the views of your own mind, automatically leads to concentrating on the clarity of your mind. We observe the thoughts, and then we let go. No intellect. We don't analyze our thoughts. Leaving the mind as it is like this is the special emphasis of this meditation. In our Lamrim meditations, we analyze. But Mahamudra meditation emphasizes not analyzing. Because when the mind is analyzing, it's trembling, shaking. It's like an airplane when it's turning, it shakes, doesn't it? Lama Tsongkhapa said that when we contemplate the consciousness, we should not follow any object, such as form or colour or sound, or even the image of a Buddha, a mantra, a syllable. These we should abandon. These are all valid ways of meditating, but not in this particular kind. That's what we're inferring here. We refer to this approach as non-conceptual, non-superstitious. In Tibetan, we say mitopa kyongwa, maintaining a non-conceptual state of mind. I think this is very sensible, very logical. Of course, our habit to follow the five senses, the five sense objects, is strong, so we need to learn to develop the skill in meditation to stay on the consciousness itself. I think for Lama Tsongkhapa, using our own mind as the object of concentration is a very sensitive, direct way to realize the universal reality of our consciousness. It easily eliminates the superstitions and confusion. This is the point, which easily leads to the universal reality of non-duality, Mahamudra. No need to clean the mind. Now let's practice. Can you just do it the casual way, even as I'm talking, as you wish, just listen. Just watch your thoughts. Maybe not literally watch. Language is a problem. Be like the sunlight, which merely shines. Normally we think our mind is bad, deluded, and that we have to make it clean. But mind's nature is clean clear. Clarity is a fundamental characteristic of mind. In Buddhism, this applies both in philosophy and in meditation. You don't need to make effort to make your mind this way or that. You just need to leave it alone. So this is another approach, okay? What we were saying before was, get your focus on your breath, and in your daily life, because you are bopping around, then you're utilizing your skill to pay attention, to listen to all the crazy thoughts and to work with them and analyze them and think about them and change them and get insight into them. It's a very particular practice. This is a completely different one. This is in your meditation cushion. And you can even apply this in your daily life as well. So this is a distinct different technique. Often we just confuse all these words that sound like a big bundle of things, but there's quite distinct techniques applied at all these different levels, you know. So you don't need to make effort to make your mind this way or that. You just need to leave it alone. Its clean, clear nature is pure from the beginning. And this nature exists forever. If you can find the object to some extent, if you can locate, you know, because it's hard when you start to watch over your mind. The breath is easy. But this is like, oh, what am I watching? What am I breathing? What am I watching? What's my mind? What does it mean, what's my mind? I get confused, you know. If you can find the object to some extent, and they always talk this way, meditate, the mind is the subject, and always whatever it cognizes is its object. It can be very subtle. It doesn't mean a physical thing, it doesn't mean that. Whatever the mind cognizes is the object of the mind. And every level of mind has its own very specific object. We'll get into this in more detail later when we'll talk about ultimate reality. It's very delicious. If you try too hard to... Okay, so if you can find the object to some extent, just let go. Let go. But if you try too hard to make it right, you will lose it and distraction will come. No expectations. Abandon expectations. Any hope, say, for a higher realization. I remember one time, this was almost tears with a poor man. He'd been doing something like meditation, I think Zen or something. I don't know much about Zen, but I'll tell you what he said. And he was in tears. He said, I've been meditating for 25 years, waiting for a realization to come. That's like a nightmare. That's like waiting for a girlfriend to come. You go mad. That's total 100% attachment. Hungry, waiting, expecting, wanting, like some magic to come, like some moment of, you know, enlightenment. You feel like you're really distressed. That is beyond insane. It's just practicing attachment. Abandon expectations of any kind, in fact. Just let go. Keep the concentration strong and be satisfied with that. Like Lama Tripitaka, the author of the text, the 17th century text that Lama used as his commentary, which is the first text on Mahamudra to be used, said you should not, quote, allow your conceptual mind to entertain any fears or expectations and to enter concentration without the slightest distraction. In other words, when you've reached a reasonably clear point, without emotional disturbance, don't start worrying or get too excited. No, just leave it there. There's another whole approach. But it's similar to when you're watching the breath, that's what you're trying to do as well. The thoughts are all there. But the goal isn't to think about them. The goal isn't to wish they weren't there. The goal isn't to analyze them. The goal is to leave them there. It's a very powerful practice. And absolute certainty, we can bring this practice into daily life. Because normally, if we're absorbed with our own thoughts, we're also absorbed in the outside world. So when you get more skill at doing this, then a big noise comes, you won't get thrown by it. You'll just leave the noise there. You won't even need to have an opinion by it, because you're more stable and centered and in yourself, more paying attention. Whereas we're so scattered like little children normally. Overwhelmed by our own rubbish, and overwhelmed by the rubbish of the world. We go pulled from pillar to post. So the concentration meditation definitely helps you anchor your mind and make you more in charge, and so you don't need to follow every thought, and you don't need to follow every sound, and you don't need to have an opinion about every damn person on the planet. You leave it there. It's a powerful practice. Very beneficial, very helpful, very relaxing. But we're like these demented beings who have to have an opinion about, a political opinion about the entire universe, every second. No, you don't. Back off and mind your own business. It's a good practice. Avoid even positive concepts. Avoid all concepts, even positive ones, such as how wonderful of all sentient beings can reach Buddhahood. Not in your meditation, not in this one. Have it another time, fine. That is not valid here. Even if you have a memory of your past life, some Himalayan yogi, or some fantastic vision, even if the Buddha comes, do not follow it. Let it go immediately. Don't think that I'm trying to get you to forget about everything in your normal life. Maybe I should just go to sleep and forget everything. No. Panchen Lama mentions this. It's not the But it's not the cessation of mental activity as when you faint or fall asleep. That's a big misconception. Just falls into dullness where there's no thoughts. That's just idiocy. That's just nihilism. It's not at all like that. No, he says. In the development of concentration, all such thoughts are interferences. That's why you need to stop following them. Stop following them. Because our habit to go to the form, the sound, the colour, the smell is so deep, we must use great skill to keep our awareness strongly on our consciousness. We also have the habit to go to the past or the future. We get so distracted and we live like that. We must break this habit too. Remain focused on the clean, clear state of your own consciousness. The yogi Tilopa says to place the mind on the consciousness alone without anything else. Eventually our muddy consciousness, our superstitions, all the crazy thoughts will settle and become clear. Continuous, non-stop mindfulness, good memory, but not forgetting what you're doing, is the resource of awareness. Like the sun. Your consciousness is like the sun. Just like the sun's rays shoot out from the sun, our thoughts, our views, right views and wrong views, manifest from our consciousness. Whatever thought you experience, keep your mindfulness of it continuously. That is the meditation. Like space. Your mind is like space. When the rain comes, the space is not disturbed. Rain falls, but still it's part of space. When the rain is strong, it's disturbing, but when it stops, things become quiet and peaceful again. The rainfall is similar to your superstitions. And let me use that word. They have it in Tibetan Buddhist psychology, and it's a variation of a delusion. So it sounds weird to say superstition, but basically when you're superstitious, you believe in something that doesn't exist, isn't it? Well, Buddha says when you have attachment to cake, the cake on that plate is not the cake existing on the plate. The one the attachment sees is not the cake that's there. So you've got superstition. We exaggerate and distort everything. So it's a good word. The rainfall is like similar to your superstitions. When they are manifesting, it's disturbing. But they still have non-duality nature, still their original nature. Like the ocean. Your mind is like a blue ocean. It's there, you just watch it. Your thoughts are like the waves. Waves manifest from the ocean, but they are still part of the ocean. When a wave rises out of the ocean, there's some turbulence. But when it drops back into the ocean again, it's not different from the ocean, is it? Like the full moon. Your consciousness is like the full moon. On this earth, all the people and fishes and chickens and trees, all the organic things are moving, functioning, but the full moon is just there. Your intensive awareness remains intensive awareness of consciousness, even though the distractions themselves are coming and going. They no longer energize you. They no longer distract you. You remain on your thoughts with intensive mindfulness. As Dr. Jyoti Gyaltsen, that's the Panchamama, says, tighten by making taut and look nakedly at the nature of that which is clear and knowing. Your mind, in other words. And recognize any conceptual thoughts that arise. Learn to let go. When you reach the point where you can experience the clarity of your consciousness, then try to let go. Keep your concentration a little loose rather than exerting tremendous effort. Don't squeeze your mind. Too much effort, too strict discipline is not good. You need to learn to let go. Keep your mindfulness continuous and experience the clarity. When the mind is stable, let go. In this state, you experience quiet, joyfulness, even bliss. Let go has many meanings. When you drive a car, for example, once you were aware of the right speed, the overall situation, then you need to just let go and relax. Let go, relax. When you relax, you can enjoy the drive. It's always as if the car is flying, isn't it? But new drivers can't do that. They're always trying to adjust things. They're too nervous, too tense. It's the same with new meditators. You have to learn to let go. If you don't know how to let go, you can never experience bliss. When you try too hard, you get headaches and high blood pressure, and eventually you hate meditation. That's the sight of your cushion. Meditation cushion makes you want to go nowhere near it. So learning to let go is extremely important. When you know how to let go, the root text says, you'll be liberated from superstition. Quotes, when mind bound in a tangle is relaxed, without doubt, it frees itself. Well, you know how to let go. You taste the blissful chocolate cake of meditation. Then each time you go to meditate, you will enjoy it. Don't reject distractions. Don't feel bad when distractions come. Don't get upset and reject them. There's no need to think, oh, this is ego, it's bad. Recognize that these deluded thoughts, the dualistic thoughts, the superstitions, are simply a manifestation of your consciousness. Look at the essential nature of the thoughts. They are also clear in their nature, as we discussed. When they come, instead of rejecting them, look, then penetrate into their essential nature. Or think that the thoughts are like the birds, the airplanes, all the organic things that move in the space of your consciousness. They come and they go. Just let go. You can use your awareness to watch the essence of the superstitions. You don't need to lose the awareness. You can use your awareness to watch the essence of the superstitions. You don't need to lose the awareness. This is a really crucial point. You're conscious of the noises behind. You're recognizing it's a car, but you don't lose focus about doing your work. You know, you're focusing on the computer, but you're not stupid. Your mind is quite capable. You can recognize car, bird, this, that. But you can still focus. And of course, as you get deeper focus, then all the distractions literally go away. A bomb can block, go down the road, you won't hear it. Because you've gone to a more subtle level. But we can get so much benefit. Before we get to the subtle level, don't worry about it. It's learning to navigate and learning to be skillful and learning to know how to work with your thoughts. You know, that's the point, not just desperately wishing they'd go away. That's the biggest mistake. That becomes frantic, you know. Or waiting for a realization to come. It's just attachment, it's neurotic. If too distracted, relax and watch the breath. If the distractions are too strong, it's better to stop the meditation on the consciousness and do the 9-round breathing meditation. We'll do that another day. We'll do that another time. Or you can simply watch the breath. Breathing meditation is simple. Breathe, but don't think about the breathing. Using the breathing technique, we can help our supersensitive schizophrenic mind calm down so that we can again contemplate the clear mirror of our own consciousness. Sometimes people don't know how to breathe and that creates tension. Notice that when you are sad or depressed, you sigh deeply, don't you? Breathing is very important for health. You should be sensitive to the movement of your breath. Breathing well can even energize bliss, while breathing wrongly can cause problems. These techniques can quickly cut the gross levels of the superstitions, and soon you'll reach a point where your mind is more neutral and you can go back to the clarity of your mind. Persevere and be satisfied. It's important to put energy into the practice from the beginning and to not give up. The texts illustrate this with an example. If you want to make fire by rubbing two sticks together, you have to be persistent. You can't just give up and then start over. It'll never work. It's the same with your concentration. Lama Tsongkhapa emphasizes that when you get some experience of clarity, be satisfied. Don't think, oh, this is not enough clarity. This is not what my Lama needs. You understand. You're over-intellectualizing. You need to discover what is right through experience. Don't go by new words. Perhaps you have special experience in meditation, and then they go away. Experiences. Don't be disappointed. They are valuable. They are your experiences. It has nothing to do with intellect, nothing to do with books, nothing to do with my words. It's important to recollect these experiences. They show you what you can achieve. And other times, you can have perfect experiences, but you don't recognize them. You just throw them into the garbage. When I do retreat, I have some experiences too, small experiences. When I recollect my retreat, I'm satisfied. I'm not saying I have great experiences, but they're good enough. I think all of us can have moments of bliss, or even of simply not being disturbed by the context. That's super. Remember these times. They're your experience, not anyone else's. Retain the clarity outside of meditation. With Mahamudra, you don't need to do anything formal. The clarity of your mind is with you 24 hours a day, so it's possible to retain the experience during your breaks as well. You use your mindfulness and leave your mind on the clarity of your own thoughts. This is very simple. You can apply it in any situation. You see, this is another approach. What I said before was, there's different approaches. So, like I was saying, we go into daily life, and you become more conscious of the thoughts, but you can do your analysis if you need to.
You can do it, shut up the breathing, relax the breathing, give it a break, don't do that, work out your problem, get insight into it. This is another approach where you step out of it and you see the thoughts, even in your daily life, but you don't go there and have all these opinions about it. This is a powerful technique. This is really excellent. It makes us much more stable, instead of all the time jumping in on ourselves and having opinions and about the outside world too. It's very powerful. While you can apply it in any situation, while you're drinking tea, while you're eating, walking, talking, even while you're dreaming, part of your mind is always aware of the clarity of the thoughts. So you focus on a very particular thing. You see all the thoughts of the crazy, noisy thoughts, and you're attempting to experience the clarity of them, sort of the clear nature of them, not something concrete and solid. You allow them to come and you allow them to go, with always attacking them, instead of always attacking them and being involved in their stories. It's like a great relief to do this, you know. Normally you're busy with your fantasies, transfixed by your thoughts and ideas, where you're always thinking, oh, I'm so confused, and there's no sense of clarity. But the clarity of your mind is always accessible. It makes no difference whether you are feeling confused or miserable, blissful or fantastically clear. All these feelings in your mind, when they are clear in their nature. Every situation can become a meditation. Just watch your own mind, the views moving through your mind. When your emotions are strong, instead of focusing on the object, the person, focus on the mind itself. This is the essence of Buddhist practice, that sentence. We are utterly absorbed by the object, obsessed with it. Here, especially in your own emotions, when the person gets angry at that person, we can see the person's difficulty because of their voice and we concentrate on them. It's really powerful not to do that. Hear the angry thought. Feel your own pain. Hear that focus on your thoughts themselves. It's so powerful. Instead of making your mind busy with the dualistic judgments about the person or other external things, simply keep your mindfulness on the subject. The subject meaning the mind itself. At a certain point, it will become clear. You keep your mindfulness on whatever's arising and you let go, without intellectualizing or analyzing, okay? This is beautiful. Whatever situation you're in, you immediately remember the clarity. Once you've developed this habit, you can bring it into any situation. You're developing mindfulness. That's what concentration meditation is. Okay? Quite beautiful. So, let's see the dinner differently. You see, again, it's the handiwork of all these kind people, the creatures who died, all those sentient beings who got killed in the pursuit of our legends. Yeah. They're sentient beings too, but just the cows and the birds that we eat. So, have compassion for these kind sentient beings, and the people who cook the meals, and fed us, and prepared us. So we're going to eat this delicious food. Or just bless it. We'll do a little thing here. Imagine the three essential. We'll bless it. We'll imagine blessing with the energy of the enlightened body, speech, and mind by visualizing the three essential Sanskrit syllables, Om Mahal, melting into the delicious food. Om Mahal, Om Mahal, Om Mahal. So imagine now it's a little delicious nectar in a big container, vast as space, blissful. And now we imagine offering it. So we just think, use our creative imagination, all the Buddhas, all the holy beings, all the suffering sentient beings, of all the realms of existence, imagine them pervading space. And then imagine if I could, I would happily offer this blissful nectar to every one of them. Then we imagine them all experiencing the joy of receiving it. Lama Sangye Lama Chö Dejen Lama Gedon Te Kunji Jepo Lama Te Lama Namla Chö Pabu. And enjoy and have discussion about what we talked about. And see you at 7:30, I think, isn't it? Yeah? 7:30? 7:30.